With that, I would present to you tonight Ms. Megan H. of the 164 Group.
Can I turn it off? No, I'm joking. I'm Megan. I'm an alcoholic. Let's see. My sobriety date is November 24th, 2010. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor others. It was hard to say. I'll get there in a second. Really nervous for some reason, and I normally always get a little bit fired up for speaking, but more so tonight than normal. But this group taught me a little prayer in the book that I refer to as the fear prayer. And I've been saying it over and over again for the last probably hour. And I don't know. It's going to be okay. Whatever happens. Okay, let's see. I will be 28 years old this month. I am from Eastern Kentucky, in case you can't tell. I'm finding out more about my genealogy as we speak, but apparently alcoholism's been in my family for a long time, but do I think that's why I'm an alcoholic? I don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg. I know that from the first time I drank alcohol till the last time I drank alcohol, I had a reaction different than the people I saw around me. And that being said, the first time I drank, I was 11 years old. I lived with my mom, and my stepfather used to keep a big, I think it's a gallon, I don't even know, I'm not good at that kind of stuff, of vodka over the fridge, and nobody ever touched it. And I noticed it, and finally one night I had a fellow cheerleader over with me, and I was like, do you want to drink this? And she's like, okay. And so I got schwasted, and she barely touched it. I ended up, which this is throughout my drinking, getting violently sick because I tried to drink way too much, way too fast, and probably got alcohol poisoning the first night I drank. Throughout my story, I overshoot the mark almost every time when I drink. I'll intend to just get drunk enough to where I'm feeling good and loose and not caring, but I don't have an off button. That being said, I can remember specifically laying there with my face on the side of the toilet seat and loving the way the cold felt while I'm laying there throwing up with the dry heaves. Most normal people, I think, would not drink after that, and I didn't immediately. I'll go ahead and start off by saying I didn't drink beer. Hated beer. The few times I drank beer, it was there was a funnel attached to the other end of it. Hated the way it tasted, and there have been times when my brain held on to this for a long time, thinking that since I turned away beer, that I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic because I would lay there sick before I'd drink a beer. So I couldn't be an alcoholic, and that's not true. The truth is that I just didn't like it. I would rather drink warm piss, personally. But, excuse me, I'm not supposed to curse, but because it's being recorded. But I ended up, you know, I was the little golden child. I was straight A's in everything, the captain of everything, gymnast, cheerleader, could do things most normal kids couldn't, and my dad absolutely loved it. And my parents got divorced when I was at a very young age. They both got remarried, and I did not like either one of my new step-parents. And me and my older brother, who is 4 years older than me, did not get along at all. And I was the golden child, and he was kind of he's got a lot of heart. And whatever happened, I don't know if it was the people I was running around with or I just had always felt different. I'd always been stubborn. I'd always been argumentative. I always just that ick inside me. Whatever happened, I started hanging out with a different crowd, dating an older boy, and figured out that if I hung out with certain people, like my friend, I would go to her house on the weekend, and her dad would let us drink because he had abandoned her as a child, and so he would buy us alcohol as long as we drank in his house. So I would find out the friends whose parents would let us drink, and that's where I would go every weekend. Except for I'm the type of drunk that whenever I drink, I want to go home. So that didn't work too well because I'd call my mom drunk, and she would come and get me and I'd get in trouble. And I did pretty well with not even, like, I probably went a couple years after 11 without drinking again. And, you know, I was way too good for that. I used to, like, look down my nose on people that did that kind of thing. And then I started smoking and I started doing all the other things. And I figured out that if I did other stuff, that I wouldn't get sick and throw up as quickly. But I could still have fun. And this is Alcoholics Anonymous. I am an alcoholic. I have a desire to stop drinking. But the combination of alcohol and sedatives land me on the rocks pretty quickly. I believe in my heart that if it not, had not been for the prescription medication that I was taking, I would have had probably another 10 years of drinking to do and would have suffered 10 more years. So I'm grateful that those things got me in here quicker. Where am I at? I'm still in high school. No, I'm not in high school yet. Okay, so I start slowly liking to drink and party more than I like doing the things that I enjoyed doing. Like, gymnastics became a secondary choice. Hanging out with my family and being a part of became a secondary choice. The most important thing in my life was the weekend when I could go get drunk or go party. So I ended up giving up cheerleading eventually due to trying to tumble when I was loaded and I cracked my butt bone, and that was the perfect excuse not to go back. By the time I was a junior in sophomore in high school, I was drinking or doing something else every day. I knew I'd try to quit and I'd get 2 or 3 days and then I would say, oh, it's just the people I'm hanging around. So I would go hang out with the good crowd that I always hung out with before. And I'd be out with them for like an hour on a Saturday night. And then I would see my other friends. And so I'd sneak off and go get with my other friends and drink. And I just thought it was because I was stubborn and wild and wanted to party. I didn't realize that I had something in my brain that didn't give me the choice. I finally got clean with my parents that I had this problem. And, you know, I'd been arrested for shoplifting. I'd quit cheerleading. I'd lost a lot of things. And they sent me to a drug and alcohol therapist. And that was the first time at 16 years old I was recommended to go to a 12-step program. She had told me I could go loaded as long as I went. So I took that as, I can come to you loaded. And I waited patiently because my mom used to check me out of school and she would drive me. I would wait patiently to finally the day I got to drove myself so I could get loaded and go to the drug and alcohol therapist because I thought that was cool. I ended up totaling my car on the way because I was running late because I made a pit stop. And driving way too fast because, I don't know if it was because I was sick, it was a combination of being 16 and not, and under the influence. I ended up totaling my car and pretty much almost died. I had to be life flighted out to Lexington, Kentucky. I had collapsed lungs. My spleen was ruptured. A tear in my aorta. My ear was cut off. Like, all kinds of jaw broken, all kinds of crazy stuff. And at that moment, I knew that my problem, at that point, I thought my problem, it's the drugs. Alcohol I can do every now and then, it's the drugs. If I can just stay off that, I'll be fine. So the pain medication they gave me to deal with the recovery, I didn't want to take it. Within 2 weeks, I had people sneaking me in liquor. And then within a couple weeks of drinking vodka, I started on the other stuff. I'd never put two and two together that it was all the same thing for me. And that it always started and always ended with drinking. And drinking was always there. And a way for me to try to control my alcoholism was through doing other stuff, because it took the light off the fact that I was 95 pounds drinking a fifth in an hour, and there was something wrong with that, that I wanted to be that out of it. So a series of events after my accident, I get back on drinking and the other stuff, and I can't stop. And my parents give me an ultimatum, and I end up moving out of the house, moving in with quite an older man so I could do what I wanted to do and drink the way I wanted to drink. Because when my mom caught me, I could hide the other stuff better than I could the alcohol. If I came in drunk, my mom knew it. If I came in other stuff, she didn't quite figure it out as easily. So by 18, I'd landed myself in treatment for the first time. I barely graduated high school, and the only reason I did is because my stepfather was assistant principal. Sucked whenever I tried to lay out, but it got me through high school. So I ended up in treatment for the first time at 18. And the first few times I was, the when I first got there, I'd make, get like 30, and they introduced me to AA. Can still remember my first AA meeting. Can't remember what they told you, but I can remember where I was at. It was in Atlanta, Georgia. So they shipped me off from Eastern Kentucky to Atlanta. My father was a proud alumni, and my brother was a proud alumni of that treatment center. Anyway, I would get about 30, 32 days sober, and I would relapse in treatment. And it finally, like, I didn't come to AA, and I didn't go to treatment because I wanted to quit. I went so I could get people off my back, and I figured I would learn some secret that would keep me from getting in trouble, and I'd learn how to control it. And the only real moment of clarity I had in treatment was, there's something wrong with me if I can't fake treatment for 90 days and get out of here without drinking. Okay, so I ended up getting a sponsor and doing like a lot of the things they told me to do. I almost said everything, but that would have been a lie. And, you know, I half did this program, and I stayed sober on it for a minute. I'm not going to lie and sit here and tell you that, you know, I relapsed immediately. I stayed sober for almost 4 years, half doing the program. And, you know, I turned 21 sober, and at that point, my brain started working with me, against me, not with me. And a little sneaking suspicion, that peculiar twist that maybe it was something I grew out of. And maybe it really was just the prescription pills. And if I stayed just on the alcohol, then everything would be okay. And the reason I talk so much about the prescription medication is because I know from talking to people, there are a lot of people that come in this room because of things other than alcohol that think that they can safely drink. And my experience was I can't. And I proved it. After almost 4 years sober, I went out. And I was only out about 3 months. The first night I drank natural wine. I read that in an attempt to control. And I started daily drinking immediately. Like, you know, I thought that if I tried to space it out and try to drink like a lady, then I would be okay. And since I was in college now and I just drank with the way those girls did, then I would be okay. And the truth is, when I was with them, I would drink like they did, but I wasn't including the few shots I took before and then whenever I would go home and drink the rest. I didn't sit there and think about the fact that I was living alone in my own apartment, still had liquor hid throughout my house in case somebody came over and found my stash and poured it out, because my parents knew I'd been sober. And in my head, if they found the alcohol, they'd pour it out because they didn't want me drinking. I didn't think like that stuff was odd. I just thought that's what you did. So then a couple months of drinking and some other stuff, I realized I got scared. The knowledge, you know, I've heard it shared in meetings, you can't drink, you can't have a belly full of beer and a head full of AA, it doesn't work. It really doesn't, it scared me to death. So as soon as I started getting a little bit of the unmanageability and consequences, I hightailed my butt back into treatment so that I could get back to AA. And it was a lot harder. It was a lot harder to come in after having a couple years sober, thinking I know something, thinking, okay, I just got to do what I did last time, and I'll be okay. It never occurred to me that what I did last time didn't work, or I wouldn't have drank. So after they beat me down a little bit, I agreed to go back to the old sponsor I'd fired because she was a hard ass. And I stayed with her for a while, and then I met a guy, and I wanted to go out with him, and she said no, and I was like, well, fine, I'll find another sponsor. And so there started my journey of, I had another 2.5 years sober. Things got a little better that time. I tried a little bit harder because I was scared. But the thing that had always felt to me, and I can sit here, and I've told some people in this room this before, any day you can ask me why I relapsed both times and I can come up with 10 different excuses. But the truth is, it says in the book, I can't come up, like in light of what would have happened, there's no sane reason why I should have drank again. The first two times I came in the program, I knew I needed to quit, but I didn't really want to. I still thought I had some more left in me. And for a long time, I've struggled with the fact that I gave up time, and I still think about it all the time, like, oh my gosh, I would have had 10 years sober if I just wouldn't have picked up that first drink. But the truth is, I'm okay with everything that happened today. Just today I'm okay. Maybe tomorrow I'll be mad about it, but today I'm okay. So I'd met this guy, he had 17 years sober. He taught me probably as much about the big book as this home group has. And I thought I would be okay with him. And he and I went out together after over a year of dating. And I made that my mind up whenever I can sit here and still, like, I can almost smell it when I tell you this story, that I poured the shot and I sat there and looked at it on my dining room table and I said, I'm going to ride this until the wheels fall off. Like, I'm not going to just stay out for a week and come and pick up another white chip. And I actually joked about it. I said, my story's going to be better from the podium. It's crazy. So, in the back of my head, I always thought, like, oh, when it starts, like, before, when things start to get a little heated, I can come back to AA. You know, when things get uncomfortable, I'll just have fun for a minute, and then I'll come back. And the truth is, I'm very, very lucky to make it back. I was out there for 16 months. From day one, I started, and I'm talking, like, violently drinking. I'm not talking, like, there was no attempt to control. The only attempt there was is to keep people off my back, to keep my parents off my back, to keep him off my back. It wasn't an attempt, like, to prove I wasn't an alcoholic. It was just an attempt to control the consequences. And that got to a point where that didn't matter, because I got arrested 5 times in 6 weeks. So one would think that if I was trying to control the consequences, I'd probably stop driving while drinking and doing stupid things. But I didn't. Bond after bond, and after time and time of promising I would quit, just come and get me out, I'll quit. And then as they picked me up, laughing on the way to the car in my mother's face. You really think I'm going home with you to go to treatment? You're crazy. Laughing at her. Like, that's cruel. My mom drove all the way from Eastern Kentucky to Atlanta to bail me out of jail, and I laughed at her when she picked me up. Like, that's not human. That's not me. I mean, that is me when I'm drinking, but that's not me today, and thank God for that. I would do things like call my parents and be like, and they would be like, "You're drinking." And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm just trying to come down. I'm trying to wean myself off." And my dad knows enough about alcoholism. He has it in itself. They would just be like, "Are you kidding me?" Like, I figured out a way to freeze vodka so that when my parents came over, I could suck on my little vodka popsicles and they wouldn't know I was drinking. You know, it's bad when you have, sorry for saying it again, but drug dealers put a limit on how much you can buy in a day because you're that crazy. And, like, just the insane amount of stuff that I put in my body. I like to drink to the point where I passed out and pissed on myself. I had to get all new furniture when I moved to my own apartment in Atlanta because everything had pee stains on it. Like, that's sad. My favorite place to pass out was the toilet, and I would stay there for days until somebody woke me up. And I would go 2 and 3 days without sleeping. I would go a week or longer without bathing because in my head, when I woke up without the alcohol, I didn't have enough energy and I couldn't stop the shaking long enough to get in the shower. And then in my head, once I had the alcohol in my stomach, if I took a shower, then it would sober me up. So I was like, okay, whatever. I'd brush my teeth and spray some stuff and go on about it. So basically I ended up going to, you know, 3 detoxes and 3 treatment centers later. In a 16-month period from the time I relapsed on July, which I'll get there in a second, but I couldn't stop. I would be in treatment drinking vodka out of Mountain Dew cans. Like, who does that in front of other people? Like, sitting there picking up, like, time and sitting there telling all these other people how AA worked. And you all have heard me say it, too. Like, there was a guy I was drinking with in Kentucky right before I came to Tampa. I gave him a copy of the Big Book and told him he should read it while I was drinking with him. Like, it would help him. And, I mean, I would sit drunk quoting the Big Book. Sad but true. And the thing that I think scared me the most is one of my best friends from Atlanta. I watched her get sober, and she now has, she got sober in 2004, so 8 years. Almost 8 years, she looked at me and said, "I'm just waiting for the call to tell me that I have to go help bury you. You're a goner." And I'm sad, but I've come to accept it. And having your best friend look at you and tell you that, it hurts. And having your parents look at you and go, "We know you're going to die. We wish that you would stop killing yourself," and it breaks our heart. And my mom's hair is falling out, and she can't sleep, and she can't eat. And my dad's about to get a divorce because his wife doesn't understand why he just won't tell me, like, to go fly a kite and get away. But for whatever reason, a few select people didn't give up on me whenever I'd long gave up on myself. And I had decided that I was going to be one of those bodies you all had to step over, that I was going to be one of those people that died from alcoholism, whether it be at my own hand or whether I got my boyfriend angry enough to where he would finally kill me, or whether it was driving behind a wheel, which would be at my own hand, but I was going to be one of those. And finally, I was nudged by the judge. They locked me in jail for a couple weeks, and I was scared to death after the last time I got arrested that, dear God, if I do live, I'm going to end up behind bars for 15 years. And the thought of that scared me to death. And so I agreed to come to Tampa because I remembered somebody who worked at the treatment center. I knew them from the time before. And I honestly thought that if I got away from that guy long enough that I may have a chance to get sober because he was sneaking me in alcohol and drugs into the treatment centers. And, you know, I blamed it on him, not on the fact that I would call and manipulate him to death to bring it to me. The day before I came to Tampa, I had a moment where we're driving back from the liquor store and a deer jumps out in front of the car and I go, and I had that moment of, oh, I'm going to die. And it wasn't like that was any different. The thing that was different was that little notion inside of me that maybe I didn't want to die. That was my little aha moment. Did it keep me from drinking? No. But it was that moment where I knew that I finally had that aha moment that if I die, it's game over. Computer crash, no reset, no do-overs, I'm gone. And I got on a plane, schwasted, and came to Tampa. When I got to, I went to a treatment center around the corner. When I got there, they told me I was going to a village, and I laughed at them. And they let me go sleep it off because I was pretty bad. And I fought with the treatment center a lot because, of course, I'd been in AA before, and I could quote the big book. So, y'all, you know, it's good that you're helping all these people, but I don't really need what you're giving me. I just need a door between me and the liquor store, but thank you. And so I got out of treatment, and reluctantly, and some people laugh at this, I was supposed to get out after 90 days. Well, first they talked me into staying 30, and then I was like, okay, well, maybe I'll stay 6 weeks, and they got me to commit to 90 days. Like, I had a choice. Because I was in there preemptively before the judge told me I had to go. And the fact I'd had time before was a double-edged sword. Yeah, I thought I knew something, but it also gave me hope that maybe, just maybe, I can get a couple days again. And in my head, I was like, I'll do what they tell me to do, and if it doesn't work, then I can always go back to drinking. I can do it for a couple months. I can do it until the judge gets off my back. And in October, I got to Tampa in July of 2010. In October, I went and faced the judge, and he told me I had to finish treatment, so I was stuck. And then my probation got transferred to Florida from Georgia, and I wasn't happy about that. And I was like, okay, well, I'll stay till I have a year sober, and then I'll make up my mind. I wouldn't commit to staying here because you all were weird and did AA wrong. and there were too many mosquitoes and flying cockroaches. What are those? So I ended up, I was going to do the three-quarters program at the treatment center, but they actually told me to go to a halfway house because they knew I wouldn't follow the rules long enough and that they would keep having to throw me back into day treatment. So they kind of did me a favor. And here's the hard part. This is why I'm so nervous. I got out of treatment like mid-November. Within 2 weeks of treatment, I relapsed of getting out of treatment. I smoked spice and took a Valium and never told anyone. And about the time that happened, I'd come to this group. And the light in people's eyes when they talked about the big book was not anything that I'd ever seen before. Even all the friends in Atlanta I had in AA, all the time that I'd spent quoting and learning the book so I could sound smart, it wasn't the same. And I took to one of the members of this group quite a bit. And there was something about the passion and the fire that they had about the program that I was like, okay, I don't know what they have, but I want it. And I was personally unwilling to work with a guy at that point. And that was my choice, and I stick beside of it because I wanted to do a fist step with a lady. And so he kept talking about how he had worked with all these women before, and I was like, and finally, after enough being in pain, and I can't believe I haven't mentioned bumblebees yet, but after being in enough pain, I called him and was like, okay, since you know so many women and you've taken so many women through the book, give me one of their numbers. Because if you gave them what you have, then they have what I want. So give me one of their numbers. And I ended up sitting down and I worked the steps. I worked them pretty thoroughly, probably more thorough than I'd ever had in my life. But there was that one thing I kept off. It was the fact when I got out of treatment, I had smoked spice and taken a Valium. And in my opinion, even though my desire to stop drinking, the third tradition, anytime I put anything mood or mind altering in my body, I start my sobriety date over, period. Doesn't mean I don't drink alcohol. It means I don't do anything. Because for me, if I wake up, if I put something in my body, I start that mental obsession and that physical craving all over again. And even if I wait for a couple weeks, I know it will happen. So my actual sobriety date is November 24th, 2010. In July of this past year, I picked up a one-year medallion at this group and acted like everything was okay and that had never happened. And it was the one thing when I'd sit and I'd do a written tenth step at night, it was the one thing that whenever the lady looked at me and said, is there anything else you need to tell me? It was that one thing I went, I would sit there and tell any girl I worked with, you better not leave anything off. That one thing you don't want to tell me is the thing you need to. But I was unwilling to give it up. And it ate at me. You know, I got all these service commitments and I did all these things. But at the end of the night when I went home and I was quiet and I laid down to go to sleep, all I could do was think about drinking. And it wasn't, and I don't say drinking as in the terms of using, I mean drinking. I mean getting a gallon of alcohol, and I had it planned out in my head. Okay, I can't drink one and get away with it, but if I drink a gallon really fast, I'll go into a coma, the alcohol will still be kicking in, and I'll die of alcohol poisoning in my sleep. Like, that's the way I thought about drinking, and it scared me. And a lot of things happened from the time, you know, the thing about it is because I've had time in the program before and attempted to work the steps before, I've went to my parents and I've made amends. They don't want to hear me sit and making amends right now. They really don't. And maybe they will, and I'm praying about it. About when that time's ready, it will. But right now, I'm doing the best I can to do the living amends rather than the talking amends. I call my mom a minimum of 5 times a week. Ask her how her day's going. And the fact that she can sleep at night and her hair's not falling out anymore and she's gaining weight and she's going to church. Like, those things matter. And the fact that by doing my inventory and looking and seeing where this girl that I had hated, who I considered my best friend in Atlanta for a long time, had never done anything but love me. And the reason that I was so angry at her is because she called me out on the things I didn't want to hear about myself. And to have her sit on my balcony here in Tampa in November and look at me and start crying, saying, the Megan I always knew is in there showing. Those are the things that I can't tell you how they happened, other than it wasn't me. I suited up and I showed up, and yeah, I didn't do it perfectly, and I kept some secrets. And I'll get there how that came out in a second. But knowing in the back of my head that, okay, you may see a different person, but I still got this secret. Like, that was eating me up. And I can't believe I went a whole year holding on to that and didn't drink. How I woke up that beast and still wanted to drink, the only thing I can figure is God was the only person I was being honest with about it. He and I talked about it a lot. And, I don't know, I felt like a phony. And I was a phony. I was sitting here claiming to have time that I didn't have. Because I thought that you all would look at me differently if I admitted that I got out of treatment and didn't use the tools because the treatment center didn't gear me for what I had to deal with. I needed AA. So fast forward. Oh, I've got plenty of time. For me, the first step was pretty easy. Like, I got my butt whooped bad enough to where that one wasn't that hard for me. The second step, the came to be leave. I started just stepping back and looking. Like, I couldn't explain why I was still alive. I couldn't explain a lot of things. And I'd seen, and that girl in Atlanta I've mentioned a few times, her name's Laura. I seen the woman that she came into as in 2004, and I see the woman she was today, and I saw all these people around me all the time getting AA whenever I kept going out. And I'm like, if it can work for them, why can't it work for me? Maybe it can. And I got to a point where I felt like I had nothing to lose if it didn't. And step three, that one's a little sometimes. to me, I had to keep it as simple. I'll make a decision to work the rest of the steps, and I'll try to do it a little bit better, and I'll try to be a little bit better of a person. I'm going through the steps again right now with a new sponsor. So to say I've worked the 12 steps, I have, but I'm going through them on a deeper level, especially since I got honest about what happened in November. Tell you every other time I've sat down to do the steps, because a lot of times my parents will ask me and people will ask me, and I even ask myself, what's different this time? And all these other times I've got time sober, what's different? And one of the differences is when I wrote a 4-step out, I didn't have 52 pages of resentment and one page of fears. My resentments were a lot fewer than my fears, and I got honest about everything I was scared of. And 6 and 7, I finally realized for me that it wasn't just asking God to take away the bad things, it was asking to take all of me and use my good parts for Him. My conception of what God is today is totally different than a bumblebee. And I joke about bumblebees, but I mean, I like them because when I see them, I think about God, because He shows up usually in times when bumblebees show up like in the most random times, usually when I'm doing something right. So 8, that one was a little hard. Like the last couple months of my drinking, I don't remember a lot. I'm still piecing together. Like, as I said, I like to drink to the point where I passed out. I mean, I remember slashing somebody's tires, but I don't remember, like, just some of the crappy things I said and did to people. And, like, it's weird. It comes back in jolts. Like, I was sitting at a speaker meeting on a Thursday night a couple months ago, and this one speaker, I don't often jerk my phone out during meetings. I jerk my phone out just so I could start writing down names of people, because their story had stirred up so much in me that I started remembering things. And I came up with, like, 9 people that I'd left off my 8-step list. My amends one is kind of a little bit touchy. Like, I didn't do a lot of damage here in Florida because I've only used in a 24-hour period since I've lived here. I mean, yeah, I've had some outburst, but I think I try to cover that in 10. My 9th step, for me, there's a lot of people in Atlanta that I owe an amends to, and some people in Kentucky. I've only been to Atlanta once in the past year and a half, and I don't get to travel there at my will. It's at the will of the Department of Corrections. So that one, and I believe that's for a good reason. Like my friend Laura, I told you about, I'd made a plan about a year ago to travel to Atlanta and go make all these amends, and I couldn't go because my probation officer wouldn't let me. Lo and behold, about 9 months later, she gets to come to me. And it was at a place where I was at a place where I didn't have to tell her what was different. She could see it. So God made me wait enough time to where it wasn't just words. My little sisters and my little brothers, like, that's the thing, is they haven't seen me drinking much. They just know that I've not been around. So I try to be around. My grandfather, one of the things that bothers me the most, my grandfather's always been my hero. Like I always said, whenever I get married, I want my grandfather to be the one to walk me down the aisle. He's been the closest thing to God-like that I've ever met, any walking person. And I swindled him out of $250 to go pay for alcohol. I called and lied and manipulated and cried and did everything I could and made him feel guilty enough to where he sent me money. And that man doesn't give anybody money for anything. But I'm his little Megan, and he sent it. And, you know, I made a point, because he's sick, that he was my first financial amends. And I tried to send like $20 a month or $20 a week, and that wasn't quite working because I let off on it. And so I ended up just saving the full amount of what left I owed him and mailed it to him all at once. And when I called him, he cried. And, you know, he was like, I didn't expect you to pay it all at once. You didn't have to. I hope, you know, it doesn't put you in a hard spot. And I'm like, no, it's yours. It's not my money. And that man, as close as I am to him, he never really, my family doesn't say love, and I don't know if y'all have noticed, I'm not a big hugger. My families aren't huggers. We're not huggers and kissers. We're not like, ooh, I love you people. Like, that's just not how I was raised. But to have that man every time I get off the phone with him now telling him he loves me, is something my father even goes, what? He never tells me he loves me. And I don't know, it's just the little things. It's the little things like my mom doesn't worry anymore. And I get to, this is silly, but I don't get to make daily living amends to my mother, but I get to go around to other mothers in the world. You know, some of my friends' mothers here in Tampa, I've been able to do things that I could only hope I could do for my mom to try to put mom thing back into the karma pool of life, because I took so much from my mother. And I remember, I guess it was my birthday last year, about this time last year, I just woke up crying about the fact that I had another birthday, because I really, really thought I was going to die, and I didn't care. The sad part, and I realized, thank God for those few people that didn't give up on me, no matter what. And that's the ability for another human to love another human unconditionally, to me, totally baffles me. Because I've always put conditions on my love and how I interact with you. Because if you hurt me or you don't do something I want, then I'm gone. And the fact that other people didn't do that to me, and I'm still, because I honestly believe that if my parents had given up on me and things hadn't have happened exactly the way they did, I wouldn't be here sitting right here tonight. So 10, I've gotten pretty decent at it. Like, at first I had to teach myself how to, and 9, oh, I'm going to finish 9, but I'm in the process of clearing everything up and finishing everything I need to do to get back to Georgia. I had to save money so I can go make some of those face-to-face. And it's going to happen on God's time, not on Megan's. And I have faith about that. 10, I've gotten pretty good. Like, this lady I was working with for a while had me writing a physical written inventory every night. And I've got to the point now where when I feel agitated, I can pretty much do a spot check and tell you what's going on. But even if I can't do a spot check, I know what to do. I go get pencil to paper and I write it out. And what's funny is all that time I was sitting there doing the 10th step, that little thing that happened in November with the spice, that legal marijuana, like, it kept coming up, and I'm like, nope, nope, not going to tell you. Not going to tell about you. It's all this other stuff. And I don't know, I've just gotten better about doing it, and I can definitely tell other people when they need to do it, too. sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand him. I'm definitely reading that. It says we, but that one's different. Like, for the first time, I actually, God feels like a priority rather than a requirement. Like, I tried to fake God because everybody told me fake it till you make it. And that didn't work for me. I have a God today that's bigger than anything I've ever had. He's bigger than alcohol. He's bigger than drugs. He's bigger than my boyfriend. He's bigger than my parents. He's bigger than all y'all's ability to judge me, too. Because I was scared to death. Oh, they're not going to like me, or they're not going to like my story. He's bigger than all that. And I found a venue of spirituality for me that's working right now, and I'm chasing it. And the best way I can explain it is when I sit and I study this particular conception of God, it's as closest thing to a 12-step that I've ever felt in my life. Because when I work with another alcoholic, I'm on fire. Like, I'm floating, like, levitating. Like, woo! And I can, like, it's awesome. But the avenue that I'm using to connect with my higher power right now, I feel that when I do it. And a lot of people don't understand it, and that's okay. They look at me kind of weird, because what's an Eastern Kentucky girl doing wanting to be Jewish? I'll go ahead and say that's what it is. That totally baffles them. They think I'm doing it because I'm getting married, and I'm not. So, I don't know. It's working right now. And more than anything, like, the meditation's always been off for me. Like, I can always pray foxhole prayers, but to sit and be quiet, I've never known how to do. And I'm not perfect at it. Like, sometimes I have to turn the timer on my phone and just be quiet until that timer goes off. And sometimes I'm zen-like, like, oh, I'm like, oh, look at the birds and look at the bees and look at sometimes I get a little over the top with it. But it's working right now, because God's becoming more and more and more of a natural working part of my brain. Like, he may not be the first thought, but he's moving up to the second. So that's progress for me. Let's see, what else? Oh, yeah. here recently, it was suggested for me to hit my knees when I prayed, and I was like, the religion that I'm trying to study, we don't do that. Like, no, like, start going off. And then I had that little internal thing go, that any time I've ever had a suggestion and been that against it, it's usually the one thing I need to do. And I have people in my life today that whenever I talk about being that uncomfortable with hitting my knees to pray, they will hit their knees with me and pray with me. That's amazing. You know, I've had people around me before when I've been sober that didn't care. They were just as selfish as I was. But I have people in my life today that actually want to do things like that with me. It's pretty amazing. So the carrying or practice these principles in all my affairs, that goes back to the honesty, which I think of. I switched sponsors recently, and it was a personal decision that this program taught me how to make. Like, it wasn't just I was angry and I wanted to date a boy and you told me I couldn't, so I'm going to switch sponsors type situation. I wrote out an inventory. I talked about it with another alcoholic. I prayed about it. I found my part, and I made a decision whether I wanted to stay or whether I wanted to change. And within a couple weeks of working with this new lady, I got honest about the one thing I said I never would. And it's because God's there on her balcony. I don't know how to explain it. Why am I crying? If I would have sat here and told you that I would have felt this much gratitude speaking tonight, I was annoyed. I was crabby. I drove to Orlando and back today. I was not happy about speaking. So when I just do the next right thing, which I committed to speak and just do it, like, it usually works out. I don't know, like, one of my favorite things is service work. I love general service. You either get the bug or you don't, but I have it. And thank God I have, my sponsor does too, so I get to ask her all kinds of questions whenever I'm confused. But I'm also involved in a young people's group. It's called Vicky Paw. And the cool thing is I went to that group and I told them that, you know, hey, I lied about my sobriety date. I dealt with the consequences, which was losing my position as events chair. I re-stood for it that same day and I got it again out of the hat. And if you know anything about Third Legacy voting, it's a pretty definite sign that that's somebody other than your will. If you don't know anything about Third Legacy and you want to know, I'll tell you after the meeting. I don't know what else I'm saying. All I know is I work. I don't call into work. I'm in school. I went back to school. I don't know what I'm going to do, so don't ask me. I'm just taking classes. What happened was, no. Y'all been waiting for it. I filled out the application first. And that was the hard part, was filling out the application. And I don't know, I just get to do things today that I never thought would be fun. I go crochet and knit every now and then with a group of old ladies, and I absolutely love it. Like, that's one of the highlights of my week. And what else? Oh, I got to go with another lady to the movies that I normally wouldn't have hung out with. And I don't know. I got a lot of people I know. I got a lot of people that I hang out with and go to hangs and go to dinner with and do fun AA things. But I've got a solid group of people that I could call any given hour that would be there and that genuinely care about my well-being. And I got people that remind me that it's not all that serious and to have fun. And I've got people to remind me that I'm doing okay because I'm my worst critic. Like, I'm the alcoholic that drifts into morbid reflection, and I can sit and tell you the 10 things in a day's time that I did wrong. And I've got the best friggin' home group, even though I have a love-hate relationship with y'all. I've quit y'all about 4 times, and y'all didn't even know it. My ego just wouldn't let me come in and tell y'all that I was changing home groups, but I was going to. And something happens, and I fall in love all over again. And my opinion is, and I've heard different quotes about, if you don't think you have the best home group, get involved. And that makes all the difference. I don't know. Thank you for asking me to speak. I'm not as nervous as I was. And I will finish with the bumblebee story, just so that I can live up to my name. The reason I'm obsessed with bumblebees, when I was going through the book one of the first times in Atlanta, I was absolutely against the idea of God. Anything to do with God, I can't see God, he's not there. Like, got on my little intellectual kick. And this lady looks at me and says, well, what do you know about bumblebees? And I'm like, they're black and yellow and they fly, all smart. And she's like, well, do you know, based off the basic laws of aerodynamics, they're not supposed to. And I look at her like, what are you talking about? She's like, oh, their body size and their wingspan and how many times it flaps per second, aerodynamics, they're not supposed to fly. Can you make them fly? And I'm like, no. Well, who do you think does? And I was like, huh. That was my first idea of God working in the world. Okay, well, maybe. And so it's funny. A lot of times I see bumblebees and I collect bumblebees and I am always talking about believing. They remind me that there's something bigger out there that's not me. And they remind me that there is a God, in my opinion, up in the general universe, wherever he sits, that can do things like make bumblebees fly. The cool thing is, and I'll end with this, by the time I found out that was a myth, you had already placed me in the hands of a higher power much bigger than a bumblebee. So it didn't shatter everything. So, anyway, that's it, and thank you.
Thank you once again, Megan. That was a fantastic story. Thank you.